In the area of innovation, we often hear people talking about out-of-the-box thinking. As a matter of fact, it's become such a regular comment that we begin to think that if we're in the box, we're clearly not relevant or assured of a future, and certainly not innovative and creative enough to be able to thrive and survive in the contemporary world. However, sometimes I think we have to examine really critically and carefully the things that we say and the acronyms and sayings that we create that in some way may create a frame of reference that just isn't relevant or real. This is no less so in this whole notion of out-of-the-box thinking. While it does stimulate some notions about being creative and innovative and not being captured by history and past practices and rituals and routines, it does also challenge us to think a little bit more seriously about how we create creative insights and adaptation and innovation within the context of our current role and organizations, and recognize that there is plenty of opportunity for innovation and creativity within the context of our present roles and organizational infrastructures, and that what we've really got to be able to do is not so much just always think out of the box, including out of the organizational box, but create an adaptation inside of the organization and within organizational frameworks that make it possible for people to be experimental and innovative and creative in all of the activities that they unfold. And this is a critical notion that we need to explore with a little bit more depth. Kevin Coyne, Patricia Clifford, and Renee Dai, in their recent Harvard Business Review article, Breakthrough Thinking from Inside the Box, certainly pointed out in December 2007 this reality and recognized that there is really a need in organizations for an almost semi-structured approach inside of existing organizational constructs that generate great ideas, even in our organizational settings as currently structured. And sometimes that these ideas work even better than the brainstorming and quantitative and qualitative techniques identified in innovation spaces. And so within that context, and using their information and their learning as a base, we can explore some of what the leader needs to know about creating new ideas and notions for innovation within current organizations so that you can begin the process of challenging organizations and challenging internal constructs in a way that makes sure that we can actually create innovation and creative processes within the construct of existing organizations. Coyne and his associates suggest that most professionals and leaders are very capable of thinking effectively inside their box. Everybody lives with constraints, and within the context of these constraints, they automatically explore alternatives, combinations, and they suggest permutations. If you think about hospitals in the healthcare system, nurses, for example, have been doing workarounds within the prevailing infrastructure for years. In fact, much of the time of a nurse is spent on figuring out the workarounds necessary to get the kinds of outcomes that patients need when the barriers to the institution are greater than the ability to achieve those outcomes. Nurses have historically demonstrated their ability in their workarounds to be very creative and innovative without changing the infrastructure. Now, of course, we're not suggesting that not changing the infrastructure is a value that we want to promulgate here, but in the absence of changing structure, creativity has been present for many, many years, as demonstrated by nurses' ability to successfully do workarounds, even though such workarounds are expensive and time-consuming. In fact, Coyne suggests that in some of these constraining systems and environments, the scope of thinking is not eliminated, but people become very adept at fully exploring possibilities, and in them generate all kinds of good ideas and adjustments necessary to meet needs and provide outcomes, and even develop some pretty great ones. Indeed, setting the right kinds of parameters or constraints is a matter of making sure that the right kinds of questions are raised in a way that creates boxes that are useful, but different from boxes people currently often find themselves captured by. In fact, the author suggests that McKinsey, in their strategy practice, has used constraints and boxes as a way of stimulating creativity and innovation in a number of different clients that they've worked with. Their technique involves posing concrete questions and orchestrating the process for answering those questions. What they do essentially is just challenging this notion of brainstorming, and even indicate that brainstorming itself may not necessarily always work. They suggest that many managers fail to really generate solid ideas because they often stimulate people to think outside of the box, or even assign them the task of slicing and dicing old boxes in a way that they hope will create new ways of thinking. The McKinsey found that the problem with this method is that most people are not very good at unstructured and abstract brainstorming. As a matter of fact, these random, unfocused, undisciplined processes sometimes make people very, very uncomfortable. These efforts at finding outside-the-box possibilities are limited by the very fact that they are unstructured. The challenges related to no bad ideas, for example, may only compound the confusion and disorientation of individuals who know fundamentally that there are indeed bad ideas periodically. Without some clear guidance, the author suggests that people cannot judge whether they should continue in the direction of their first notion or subsequent notions, so sometimes the direction gets lost in the process. In the second method that's often associated with brainstorming, kind of slicing data in new ways, almost always produces only small to middling insights for a number of reasons. The contents of every database correspond essentially with insights that are already recognized, and not necessarily with ones that are not yet recognized. Moreover, insights produced by recrunching available numbers or processes or thoughts probably will be discovered quickly by competitors anyway, who are likely to use the same techniques and the same data of brainstorming as your people are, and come to the same conclusions. Often, customers are incorporated into this process too, so that we can get customers' insights within the context of brainstorming. The problem with this, the authors identify, is that customers rarely know what they want or need, or know how a product can be changed or reimagined in ways that are valuable and valid. Often, you have to go through so many insights and inadequate contributions from customers that it slows the process down rather than really lends any value to the process. Simply having a customer in the room who isn't aware of the process or the dynamics or the value and doesn't bring the insight and creativity necessary to the dialogue will not improve the creative process in the room. They suggest that there's a middle path between the extremes of boundless speculation driven by brainstorming processes and the other extreme of quantitative methodological processes and analysis that usually occurs in a rather traditional and formal environment. The issue is, when you ask questions that actually create new boxes to think inside, actually help keep people from getting lost in the cosmos of the process and give them a structure or a foundation or a basis for making or comparing choices, and for knowing and indicating when they're making progress related to those choices. Posing the right question, they identify, however, is really only half the effort. A part of what must occur is that there must be a redesign of the ideation process so that obstacles are removed that interfere with the flow of ideas, so that people's aversion to speaking in groups of more than 10 can be accommodated and adjusted in a real-time way. The authors focus on beginning with asking the right questions. McKinsey learned about 10 years ago in a study at that time that in a study of how Nobel laureates and other creative people achieved breakthroughs, an interesting insight was obtained. They found that once these individuals asked themselves the right questions, their ideas began to flow rapidly and lead to specific and meaningful outcomes. This discovery prompted McKinsey to examine how successful companies could achieve or had achieved their current contemporary successful positions. They looked at two groups. The first group were large companies that became industry-shaping enterprises in relatively short times, and the second companies were those that grew from grassroots garage-based startups into firms with more than $1 billion in profits in less than 6 years. In every case, McKinsey discovered, their successes were built on breakthrough ideas that redefined the products and services in their own markets. McKinsey found that these innovations actually came from responses to specific and particular questions. As McKinsey focused in on 50 breakthrough ideas from a number of different industries and reverse engineered them into focused questions that really in some way could have led a leader to the same epiphany, they discovered that some of the questions were specific to the industries. However, what they really found out that was significant was that many of the questions are universally applicable. They came up with 21 questions for developing great new products, and that these questions actually became the core of their foundations for asking the right questions that would stimulate creativity and innovation within any context or environment. The 21 questions really fall into five specific categories. First is the do average buyers and users category, where the five questions are which customers use or purchase our product in the most unusual way? Second, do any customers need vastly more or less sales and service attention than most? Third, for which customers are the support costs, such as order entry, tracking, customer-specific design, either unusually high or unusually low? Fourth, could we still meet the needs of a significant subset of customers if we stripped 25% of the hard or soft costs out of our product or service? Five, who spends at least 50% of what our product costs to adopt to their specific needs? Second, exploring unexpected successes. Two questions related to this particular topic. Who uses our products in ways we never expected or intended? And number two, who uses our products in surprisingly large quantities? Third, looking at boundaries of our business, raised three questions of the 21 great questions. The first one was, who else is dealing with the same generic problem as we are, but for an entirely different reason? How have they addressed it? Second, what major breakthroughs in efficiency or effectiveness have we made in our business that could be applied in another industry? Third, what information about customers and product use is created as a byproduct of our business that could be the key to radically improving the economics of another business? The fourth area of the 21 Great Question focus is examining binding constraints. The first question related to the binding constraints series of questions was, what is the biggest hassle of purchasing or using our product or service? Second, what are some examples of ad hoc modifications that customers have made to our product? Third, for which current customers is our product least suited? Fourth, for what particular usage occasions is our product or service least suited? Five, which customers does the industry prefer not to serve, and why? Six, which customers could be major users if only we could remove one specific barrier we've never previously considered? The fourth area is the imagining of perfection of the 21 Great Questions. There were two questions related to the imagining of perfection. First, how would we do things differently if we had perfect information about our buyers, usage, distribution channels, and so on? Second, how would our product change if it were tailored for every customer? And finally, a series of three questions related to revisiting the premises underlying our processes and our products. The first question in relationship to that is, which technologies embedded in our product have changed the most since the product was last redesigned? Which technologies underlying our production processes have changed the most since we have rebuilt our manufacturing and distribution systems? And finally, which customers' needs are shifting most rapidly? What will they be in 5 years? Now, each of these 21 great questions, as identified in the Harvard Business Review article in December 2007, can be adapted to healthcare as well by changing product to service or using product and service interchangeably. But these 21 great questions really formed the undergirding of the key questions that had a universal character that affected the creativity and innovation that occurred in almost any setting. These same questions, the authors predict, can lead to different ideas. The most fertile of these questions can focus the mind on a subset of possibilities that differ markedly from those explored previously, and they can guide people to valuable overlooked corners of the universe that provides a framework for possible improvements or changes in the existing organization. As one develops one's own list of questions, they can be adapted to the specific circumstances or services provided in a way that would be unique to the needs of a particular organization, so that taken in aggregate and adapted, they can provide a firm foundation upon which exploration of those kinds of questions which were not historically or traditionally or usually asked can be approached and unfolded within the organization. If you as a leader wanted to be more systematic about the search for answers to these kinds of questions or creation of new questions, you can really employ a simple logic tree that starts with a high-level question and successively breaks that question down into tighter, more defined probes. McKinsey suggests that this rigor has proven useful, even in the most unusual settings. For example, they ask you to imagine that you're an editor of a trendy mass marketing magazine that covers popular music. And in it, an article consists mainly of interviews with and profiles of new singers or bands or a star of some reputation from the past. You find this formula is getting tired and old for your magazine. A simple tool like the exhibit, a music magazine's logic tree for generating fresh article ideas, would be a way of assisting the editor in pursuing a much wider range of story angles on the same trends in a way that still keeps readers engaged but uses an entirely different approach. Coyne and his colleagues suggest that there are ways that you can undertake the creative and innovative process inside the organization using what we already know about how people work best in groups. First, you might need to bound the range of acceptable ideas and then select and tailor the questions accordingly. Often you'll hear in a brainstorming session somebody say, "I had a thought that I didn't say because I didn't think it was the kind of idea that we might be looking for." This kind of constraint is frequent in brainstorming sessions because people place values on their ideas that they're not sure other people have. How often have you, as a leader, been presented with ideas that were really crazy and could not be adapted and were totally infeasible, given whatever other organizational constraints might exist? Also, how often have you looked at people who offer incremental steps when you're really looking for that great, big, hairy, audacious idea? All of these problems, they suggest, can be easily avoided if you take the time before a meeting to clarify what constitutes the criteria for, and indeed the boundaries of, a good idea in your particular case. Are you looking for a big idea, or are you looking for a safe, surefire winner? How much money do you have that you can afford to spend in this process? What level of staffing is the company willing to commit to this process or this idea? And how soon do you need to have payback? How soon does it need to be relevant or meaningful or applicable in the organization? Also, you might need to consider the particular requirements of the problem that you're trying to solve, Coyne suggests. That also helps you avoid asking questions that will lead to the same recurring insight. For example, they suggest if all customers can use your product in only one way, like large cranes use inside of industrial plants, it really doesn't pay to ask for which current customers are our product least suited, or for what particular usage occasions is our product least suited, since in this case the questions will result in exactly the same answer. However, these two questions might produce excellent and distinct insights in situations with each where each customer uses the product in several different ways, and the customers are themselves quite different from one another. When choosing among possible questions, it is advisable to go for that approach that looks at a problem from angles that are as far as possible from the way you have approached it in the past. Same question, different angles. As a whole, the leader or the group should think of a series of questions kind of as a portfolio of questions, each one creating a distinct box that comes at your situation, your circumstances, or your question from an entirely different point of view. Same question, different approaches. Once you've used these techniques or settled on these parameters, you can now tailor the language of your question to best fit the specific goals and the constraints. The wording of the question then will generate radical new ideas that are different substantially from those that will generate only moderate or low-risk ideas. On the one hand, for example, a leader of a computer vendor who asked the senior manager in the late 1980s, how can I reduce costs, would probably have elicited solid but incremental ideas like consolidate shipments or reduce staffing. On the other hand, asking them what elements of our business would we have to eliminate to cut costs 50%, and are there customers who do not need that element, could actually lead the company or the individuals to identify specific elements that might have a more direct or meaningful impact that may create a more competitive response than other companies because the question had specific clarity around parameters, priorities, and direction. Secondly, the authors suggest that you select participants who can produce original insights. You know, sometimes you have to really think about setting up a format and a process with the right players around the table in order to be able to get the kinds of insights that reveal creative or different ways of thinking about what you're doing and how you're doing it. You want to invite people for political reasons, but you really want to invite people because they have something to contribute. And setting the table becomes really critical to effectively dealing with issues inside a box. Often, you can do the same thing as you might do in brainstorming by bringing particular kinds of people to the table who have the most impact and the most to contribute to the dialogue or the discussion that's going to occur at the table. Third, you want to ensure that everyone is fully engaged. This is really about technique and process. You really have to script the process in a way that makes sure that everybody can be engaged and that the elements and techniques that you undertake ensure that people fully participate in the process. You want to make sure that you're not shy about resorting to the use of what could be called parlor tricks. You often want to make sure that you could make sure that there are teams or there are artificial constructs that can begin to increase the mechanisms through games or particular kinds of dynamics or competitions that may actually require a deeper level of involvement and engagement in order to assure that 100% of the people at the table are contributing or adding value to what's going on there. The fourth idea is that you might want to structure the meetings to ensure that social norms work for you, not against you. The author suggests that in almost every meeting of 10 or more people, the social norm is to keep quiet or to speak only a minimal amount. Now, obviously, there are actors and reflectors, and there's no problem with getting actors to share their discussions and dialogues. There's even a few people who will break the rule and fill the airtime of the committee with their ideas most of the time. A suggestion might be to break a 20-person group session into smaller groups of perhaps four. First, in any group of four, the social norm is for everyone to participate so no one can hide without seeming uncooperative. And smaller groups actually create the demand for higher levels participation. Second, if there are five subgroups instead of one combined group, five people rather than just one are offering their ideas at any given time. Finally, a good idea is to actually put all of the actors, the pushy, verbal, and acting out people, into one group so that they can dominate their own discussions and come up with their own ideas and work out their own rules without impeding or impinging on other kinds of players from participating fully within their own particular style of participation. Coyne and his colleagues suggest, fourth, that every discussion focus on the pre-selected questions. It is important for the leader to make sure that the ground rules for dialogue and interaction are clear at the outset, and that focusing on the pre-selected questions is actually the work of the group. Also, let the group know whether you're looking for big ideas or incremental improvements, what the budget is and what the limitations and possibilities are. In doing this, you're not really stifling creativity. You're setting the boundaries of the creative process in a way that is realistic, meaningful, and provides a frame, if you will, or a box, if you will, that channels the creativity in a meaningful and potentially useful way. Once small groups have been divided up and highly focused tasks have been assigned to each group, the leader should really have them spend 20 to 30 minutes discussing the one question and report back to everyone the best ideas that came out of that single question. In that way, the first 5 minutes of each session will focus on what usually happens is brainstorming and priority setting. But then, after that first 5 minutes, the participants really return to the better ideas and kind of refine and build them out. There is some variance that emerges in that process, but that variance can be embedded into the five or six really good ideas that emerge. This interplay of ideas and thoughts and development of these better ideas results in more complex, multi-layered notions that really do have a higher likelihood of growing into really meaningful, viable, and valuable ideas. Coyne and his colleagues suggest, six, that you do not just rely solely on one brainstorming or interactive session. It is surprising, they suggest, that many, many leaders limit the participation of others in the ideation effort to maybe one process or one workshop. This really ignores how people actually think and work together. Some of the best ideas emerge after the brainstorming sessions that get lost because there's no subsequent way in which those ideas can be directed and disciplined. The legitimate answers to some of the questions that come up in the brainstorming session is, I don't know, but we could find out if this workshop were ending at 5 o'clock or in an hour. And sometimes the ideas keep improving over time if they're allowed to germinate and to grow, and sometimes the thought processes that occur subsequent to high-intensity meetings yield an outcome that could not be obtained in the meetings themselves. For all these reasons, this initial creative boxed, parametered brainstorming process really should be multifaceted. It shouldn't really just be a single event. There should be subsequent activities where you can gather together and have an opportunity to share insights that occurred following the session or have been developed as a result of what occurred during the session. You might, as a leader, need to schedule follow-up sessions, or at least one or two of them, in order to get at that creativity and innovation that might not have just been generated through that one meeting. Finally, the authors suggest that the group may need to narrow the ideas to the ones that will be seriously investigated right away. Nothing is more challenging and nothing deflates the energy of participants in these kinds of sessions than leaving with absolutely no certainty that anything will happen as a result of their efforts. This is the most debilitating aspect of group process. So one of the things that as a leader you want to do is begin to focus on what can be explored right then and there for subsequent activities, what kinds of focus can be occurring as quickly as possible in relationship to the ideas that have been generated in these sessions. For most ideation sessions, the selection process really doesn't have to be very complicated. If you wait until some later point to sort out the ideas, the problem is the odds are overwhelming that they will dissipate over time, their meaning and value will simply not be sustained, and in many ways the group will begin to feel that nothing is really going to happen with their ideas. So what you really want to do in this process, different from traditional brainstorming, is to generate a very clear, specific, limited number of constructive ideas. Make sure that those ideas are clear in number, specific, somewhere between 20 to 150 ideas broken down into a particular maybe 20 or 25 ideas that can actually be focused upon, out of which some specific action can take. You need to really kind of look at picking winners out of these ideas without worrying about the disappointment of what ideas were not picked and who may be in some way disadvantaged because those ideas are not picked. The whole groundwork of the session sort of suggested that we're looking at a wide variety of ideas, most of which will not be picked. And out of the aggregation of these ideas, some of which will lead to other ideas that will subsequently be picked and explored and built upon in some immediate subsequent activity. So doing that becomes really critical to effectively unfolding those ideas. It's really important that a choice be made rather than somebody's ideas be honored, because most people want a choice made, want subsequent activity, and want some evidence that what they had done is going to have an impact and something is going to be done about it. So these really are from Coyne's and colleagues' work at McKinsey, the notions and ideas that most effectively evidence in-the-box creativity and innovation that can work within the structure of organizations without really having to stretch the walls and create whole new out-of-the-box frames and experimental labs and other kinds of contexts for creativity in smaller increments of change and adjusting in organizations that are effective and work. McKinsey found these to be effective tools and vehicles for stimulating creative and innovative ideas that can be incorporated into the normal and ordinary infrastructure of organizations that are not quite ready to take the risk of building a highly creative infrastructure. And what can also happen from this frame of reference is that the urge to create innovative infrastructures and to design different models for innovation and creativity in organizations can actually flow out of these rather less intensive and radical shifts in the organizational construct for innovation and creativity. Certainly, as leaders, these are tools and opportunities to get the process of creative thinking and innovation dynamics at least unfolded in the organization and to begin the exploration of much more deeper dynamics related to challenging and changing the organization into a truly creative and innovative environment. They are certainly a beginning point.